Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Out here, if you're doing nothing, you're doing everything right. Though on a cruise with Norwegian, even if you're doing nothing, you're still basking in the warm sun, enjoying the peaceful ocean waves. You're breathing. Don't forget about breathing. Definitely need to be breathing. So you get to do nothing or everything, but you still need to be breathing. It's like really important.
Experience the difference with cruises to Alaska, the Caribbean, and Europe. Norwegian Cruise Line. It's different out here. Visit NCL.com, call your travel advisor, or 1-888-NCL-CRUISE. Norwegian Cruise Line ships registry the Bahamas and USA.
William Bell came from a family with gang connections and where crime was considered to be the norm. But rather than wanting to escape this way of life, he instead claimed that he wanted to be in a better gang than that of his father. And he began offending at a really young age, in fact, by the age of 8. By the time he was 18-year-old, he had over 100 convictions. He demonstrated aggressive and antisocial tendencies and didn't seem to experience any remorse whatsoever once he'd engaged in extreme violence. Whilst on parole, after being imprisoned for aggravated robbery, William was fired from work experience at the Mount Wellington Panmure RSA. But rather than accepting this rejection, he decided to take the ultimate revenge. This is the horrifying case of William Bell and the RSA murders. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Let's get on with today's case. So who was William Dwayne Bell? He was born in 1978. He was born in Mangere, South Auckland in New Zealand. New Zealand is such a beautiful country, it really is. I hate it when there are blights on humanity in areas that I have just genuinely loved. It's a gorgeous place. And people who come from New Zealand, super friendly, lovely humans. Genuinely enjoyed my time there and is a place in my heart that feels like there is a void because really, I think they should just give me residency. Apparently it's not that easy, particularly at my age. But the beauty of New Zealand is it's enormously spacious. You have so much freedom, so much space, and the people there are really tolerant. That's the way I would describe my experience. And you think about this kind of individual being born in a place and space that, to all intents and purposes, is super safe. It really is impactful because these kind of human beings cause such havoc, and this human being is certainly going to do that. Apparently, Bell had a really troubled childhood. He was brought up in a very violent home, frequently receiving beatings from his father, which we all understand would not be a hospitable place to live. And as a child, you want to feel that your parents are primary carers and safe places, not violent abusers. His father, reflecting on the way that he treated his son, said that he'd brought him up using the old school methods, basically. Now, I'm imagining that Mike is suggesting that as a parent, he was bringing them up with these old school values that, when you think about it historically, should be about respect, knowing your place. All of these things are something that I too was brought up with. But abusing and physically harming children isn't anything to do with the old school. That's just abuse, pure and simple. People in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, they brought up their children in different ways. But the idea that it's just old school, it's just a bit old school beating kids, it's not. Is abusive, end of. He also did accept that maybe he had treated Bell a little bit harshly, a little bit too harsh, just a little bit abusive, just a little bit of the old beating, just a little bit of the old school. But anyway, this is what he's saying. He's saying that maybe he did act in a harsh way, but that was what he had known when he was growing up, as if it's impossible not to learn. That's why it's really problematic when people who are parents state these kind of things. Oh, well, I didn't know any better. Well, you know what? Read a book. You know what? Read the newspaper. You know what? Watch the news. There are lots of evidential situations that we can explore where we can recognise that we should change our parenting behaviour. That's why parents change and evolve. But his excuse is, well, it's what I knew, so it's what I gave to my child. And the strange thing there is, if you're growing up in an environment which feels harsh, then when you have children, you're likely in the best place to change that behaviour because you know it didn't feel good. And Mike didn't get the memo on that, just carried on. Also, he had a criminal record. He had spent time in prison. So as a father, clearly he's going to have a level of dysfunction because he's away from his child. And it's also the mentorship that's provided by a parent. Some people do go wrong and they end up in prison. and they mend their ways and they return home and they continue to live a pro-social, legal life. Even though them being away for a period of time is not ideal, and of course that's going to impact on a child that they're meant to be around, the truth is that if the child can see that that person's taking responsibility and accountability and indeed changed, it can be a lesson that is positive. Still not ideal, but nonetheless, it can be positive. In this case, he's a repeater of offences, so that's going to add to the dysfunction, and as a role model, it's going to provide a very poor role model. And both of Belle's parents had connections to gangs. So Mike, his father, was a member of the Mongrel Mob Gang, and Mike said that Belle, from a really early age, had said, "I want to be in a gang just like you when I'm older, but I want to be a member of a gang that's bigger and better than the one you're in." Now, when you break that down, even though it's toxic, it also makes perfect sense.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
We love our parents, even parents who are horrible to us. We will often have really strong alliances and allegiances to them because they're ours. They're our familiarity. They might not offer us security, but it's the only security we tend to know, even if that's a dysfunctional one, even if it provides us with a myth of security, so to speak. So for a child to look at a parent, particularly a parent who's feared, and you would be feared if you were in the gang his father was in, then there's a level of respect that comes from that. And also, you look at your parent and you think, what is it about them that I can relate to? And for Belle, it's the fact that maybe he too could emulate what his father does, which he can, because clearly you can join a gang. But he even in that moment has the presence of mind to say, but I want to be more successful in the gang than you are. And again, we see children emulate this all the time. They look at their parents, they want to do what their parents did, but do more because they believe that by doing that, it creates a level of pride. And every child wants the parent to be proud of them. So the psychological connection with a desire to supersede what the parent has done is completely natural. It's just, it's directed into the wrong place entirely. Now, when Belle gets to seven, his parents divorce, and his dad basically vacates the relationship and vacates the area to some degree because he just starts a new family. And it really impacts on Belle. Because as we could tell from what I've just described regarding how he wants to follow in his father's footsteps, he clearly has a strong connection to him, albeit with the abuse, albeit with the criminality. There is something about his father that he connects with. And his mother said that Mike used to make Belle suffer. So he said that he'd make a lot of promises that he couldn't keep. And emotionally, that is devastating for a child of the age we're talking about. Belle would be waiting for his father to come and he wouldn't come. He would tell him things were going to happen that didn't happen. And you were literally deconstructing a child's sense of self and a child's sense of the world around them every time you fail to keep up with those promises. It's totally unforgivable when deadbeat parents do those kind of things. It's really unfair to the child. It's psychologically abusive. And of course, the fallout is it's going to affect attachment. When a child has attachment issues, they are often going to struggle forming positive relationships down the line. Of course, they do on many occasions, but it's more challenging. And when people deal with abandonment, it can also mean that they're traumatized to a degree where regulating emotion isn't as easy for them. So these are all fractures in the foundations that Belle is experiencing because of what is happening in his primary years. Now, not long after his father has left and after he's being dealt these really challenging times, Belle gets taken into care. Again, now you are totally destabilized as a kid because you don't have any primary caregiver with you, and everything that was once familiar becomes completely unfamiliar. So he's sent to Weymouth Residential Centre. And the reason for this is he'd been found wandering the streets by himself, which is completely out of order when you're a child of 7 or 8 years of age. And they felt that his parents just were not capable of taking care of him. They couldn't keep him safe. They were not fit to raise him. So now, albeit that he's meant to be in a protective mechanism, it fails because he actually starts offending at this point. This is when he's just 8 years of age. So he does things like stealing money. He even steals his father's car when he's 10. I mean, TWOC, which is taken without the owner's consent, is a pretty high-level crime for a 10-year-old. Is it just me? When I used to go and sit in my dad's car when I was 10, I didn't even know how to turn it on. At the end of the day, it would have confused me to even consider starting using the gears. I wouldn't have known that you needed a clutch to do so. But he obviously is au fait with this, and he actually steals his father's car. And I think as well, there's a message in that as well. You know, if you take your father's car, who's let you down massively, it's a message of power and dominance. It's saying to his father, I don't have to respect you. I don't have to follow your rules. You've let me down. So I'm not going to value your property. And it's a punishment to some degree. Then when he's 14, just 14 years of age, he's stealing because he likes to get extra money. So he's a thief. But then he actually starts to use his body. So he's being sexually exploited. It's as simple as that. But he isn't considering it sexual exploitation. He thinks that he's getting money using his body and it's an easy way to make money. He doesn't realise how damaging that will be for him on a psychological level. And one of his caseworkers would later say that Bell was abused by his grandfather and even by his grandfather's friends. And we know this. If you're a child sexual predator, if you're a pedophile, you are without a doubt going to be surrounded by people in a network who also value the same values that you have, that are disgraceful human beings, that are a blight on our humanity. You surround yourself with them. You give yourself a permission base. These pedophilic predators, disgraceful, but they're also very well connected. They can just sniff each other out. It's as simple as that. And then as soon as they have a child who's vulnerable, they will pass that child around. So he's being passed around, both his grandfather and his grandfather's friends, but he didn't apparently realise it was abuse. He just thought it was a way to get an income stream. And on one level, we can say he was so desensitised to being treated so badly that when he was treated so badly, if there was a price tag, it felt better than what had happened to him previously, because at least he's earning an income. But we could also say that he has absolutely no connection. He's so disassociated from what he's doing, there isn't necessarily a connection when it comes down to his emotional fallout, but that's probably heavily linked to trauma. So people can desensitize and disengage with a traumatic experience, but it's going to come out in some other behaviors. And if you think about the powerlessness and helplessness that sexual abuse causes, if you have certain antisocial personality traits on top of enduring this kind of abuse, you may seek power and domination in other areas of your life where you don't feel that level of helplessness. And the rage that you may not even be aware of that lies beneath the surface because of your maltreatment, that has an opportunity to fester and again be projected elsewhere. This isn't to make any excuses for the case today. This isn't in any way to reduce accountability to Bell. It's just to explain the possibilities as to what eventually becomes a murderous scenario involving this particular killer. His social worker said that from the really early days, he was out of control. We also have to acknowledge that he was a severely abused and sexually exploited child, so it makes sense that he would be out of control. I also feel that if social workers were aware that he was using his body to sell himself to get money and they didn't intervene and prevent that, well, that is an absolute failure of protection at the highest level. How is a child meant to protect themselves from these kind of predators, particularly paying predators when a child needs money? And also particularly paying predators when a child needs money and also is probably looking for some form of attention. The social worker said that the longest she'd known him actually stay out of trouble was just 3 months. And this demonstrates that he's a habitual offender. But like I said, as a child, there may be lots of problematic personality traits, but he's a child. So what kind of intervention could have occurred to deflect what we see down the line when we think about the crimes we're looking at today? Now, when he was 10 years of age, his uncle was actually convicted of manslaughter. So it's everywhere. It's like running through his family and to some degree running through his DNA. His uncle had stabbed somebody whilst he was drunk at a party. And if you think about the influences that Bell has in his life, he has no positive influences. Now, in 1992, he returns from care to live with his mother. At this point, he now has dependency issues. So he's got a history of alcohol and drug abuse, but if you are a sexually violated child, then often you're going to find a way to self-medicate. Also, it would make sense that during those episodes of being sexually molested by paedophiles and predators, that you're going to need something to soothe that experience. So alcohol and drug abuse will probably be helpful to take you away from what's going on, both during and after these kind of events. He apparently frequently used cannabis, but also methamphetamine. So interesting, because you're looking at two sides of a very different coin when it comes down to drug use. Cannabis, of course, is something that many people feel mellows them out. And then methamphetamine is something that really riles them up. So again, it suggests the chaotic character where he's concerned, needing the energy and the excitement and the vigor that he probably believes methamphetamine gives him, versus the relaxing, chilling, and maybe dosing out the feelings that he has using cannabis. That could be an explanation why he goes with those particular drugs. And of course, alcohol, we know, is an anesthetic. It makes you forget. Now, in 1997, this is when Bell is 19 years of age, he gets involved in a really horrific, out-of-the-blue attack, I would say. So he attacks a worker at the mobile service station. So he just attacks this worker with a baton and then steals money from the cash register. Now, the victim very fortunately managed to escape. He locked himself in the bathroom. This is after the initial beating. But this initial beating is likely to have turned deadly if he hadn't been able to escape. And when Bell starts to actually bash down the door, which must have been utterly terrifying for this poor employee, this guy manages to run past him using a chair to basically keep him at bay. So without doubt, it is an absolutely lucky escape that this guy survives at all. Now, when it comes down to Bell's motive for the attack, when they ask him, why on earth did you do this? He said, I kid you not, I wanted a job at the petrol station, but I wasn't accepted for the position. Like, just break that down for a minute. Sorry? Yeah, I wanted a job at the service station, so they didn't give it me. Okay. You do realise that when you apply for a job, there are other applicants and there may be an applicant who's better than you? Yeah, but I don't think they should be. Do you not think that maybe not beating people would be a good start if you want to actually get a job? Well, I think that, you know, maybe beating people into giving me a job could actually be a way forward. Honestly, that was what he said. Not that I just said, but that's what he said. He said the motivation was the attack was that he hadn't been accepted for a position. So the person who was actually behind the desk, that person represented a blocker to his success. Maybe he even projected that that person got the job over him, and how dare that person who got the job over him. But also, it demonstrates that lack of impulse control, because the idea that you would go and you would actually physically almost kill somebody because they hadn't accepted you for a job that lots of people have applied for means that he hasn't got the logical understanding and consequential impact of his actions when he considers what he's going to do. And this is also why I said earlier on, when you've got that festering rage within you about helplessness, and then somebody makes you feel helpless again, you can use that to give you permission base to take out all of that anger, that seething resentment that you have for the world that you've experienced, and project it onto an innocent party. In this case, some poor guy who is just serving at a petrol station. But like I said, that's the warped logic of Bell. Now, it's at this point, by the way, that he carries out this horrific assault, that he already had an extensive criminal history. He had over 100 prior convictions, and they weren't for small things. So they were for assault, they were for aggravated robbery, theft, presenting a firearm, trespass, fraud, drug charges, a whole heap of them. And he'd even gone as far as impersonating a police officer at one point. He took a police car and literally pulled people over. I mean, that's intriguing, isn't it? The fact that he didn't just take the police car, he was like, well, got a police car, may as well just use it to pull people over. Just do a bit of role play, just a little bit of role play, just pulling people over for absolutely no reason. in my head, hoped that he was actually giving them some kind of advice on their driving, or maybe advising them that one of their headlights was out, but I doubt it probably played out that way. But also the fact that he goes and takes a police officer's vehicle, it clearly demonstrates that he's saying, I don't have to follow the rules. He doesn't see the boundaries that you or I live by. And again, that's going to make him dangerous. His criminal record was said to be so lengthy that it reportedly spanned over 6 pages. Now, that aggravated robbery that involved the horrific assault, he got 5 years in prison for that. And the judge said that what was really striking was that the robbery was almost incidental to the attack. So the robbery meant nothing. Taking the money wasn't really part of it. It was just wanting to hurt that person. And he had reportedly said to his victim whilst he was attacking him that it's not the money that matters to me. So he's even letting that victim know as he's beating him, this isn't why I'm doing this. And that must have been even more terrifying for the victim, because they're thinking, please let this be a robbery. Please let him stop beating me and just take the money and go. The fact that he's saying this isn't about the money, well, that's going to confuse the victim.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
It's either going to be that they're going to kill you, that's why they're beating you, or they're doing it for something that you're not aware of that you can't solve because you're not aware of it. The judge also said that there were aspects of his personality which indicated a tendency to antisocial behaviour. I'm really sorry that I laughed at that point, but I don't get it when a judge says something so obvious. This guy literally beat up an innocent person doing their job because that person got the job or was working at the place where he wanted the job, and that was the only motivation. And he says that there is a tendency to antisocial behaviours. A tendency. No, there is just antisocial behaviour. It's not a tendency for it. It's not something that I'm drawn to. It's not something that I tend to resort to. It's something that I am. He is antisocial, full stop. And he did say that he felt that antisocial behaviour was ingrained in him. It does. It runs within his veins. Like I said, it's clear that it runs within his veins. Bell was released after only serving around 2/3 of his sentence. This is in 2001. And the reason that he's released after just doing 2/3 is due to a law which applied automatically at the time. So the parole board weren't even able to challenge it, no matter how dangerous this human being could have been. But they did actually make some conditions that he needed to adhere to once out in prison. In the UK, we would have a license agreement where somebody has to act in accordance with their license, and if they don't, they can be returned to prison. In this case, Bell was told he had to attend counselling for his alcohol and drug use. He had to get a job, which he had to be approved by his probation officer. He also had to see a psychologist. Unfortunately, Bell was like, yeah, I'm not going to do any of those. And at that point, he should have been returned to prison. If you're not following the conditions of your release, you're not safe to be released. I'm just throwing it out there. But apparently they didn't get the memo for that. So in 2001, he gets hired for work experience as a bartender at the Mount Wellington Panmure RSA. The RSA stands for Returned Services Association. Now, he didn't actually tell his probation officer about this role, and you understand why. The probation officer is not going to want him to be working at a bar. This is a man with a violent tendency in his nature, according to the actual judge. And he's somebody who we have seen can't handle anger very effectively. And on top of that, he's somebody who has had drug dependency and alcohol dependency issues. So a bartender is literally the worst job anybody could ever be given. So he's not going to tell his probation officer because the probation officer is clearly not going to validate it. Equally, we have to question the motives that he has for getting the job. Clearly, it's not about ingratiating himself to his probation officer because he's not telling them. Maybe it's because there is money coming in to the bar and he feels like it will be an easy take, so he can steal quite easily from it. Maybe it's because it will give him free access to alcohol. Or maybe we could say at the very core root of hope that he's thinking, oh, I could do with a bit of work experience. I'll get a job and up my skills. But I doubt that was the one. But like I said, probation are not aware of it. And if that had been the case, they would have stopped him doing it. The staff straight away are like, we should not have this guy working here. for all the reasons that I've just mentioned, but also because they were in an experiential position where they noted that there was something truly wrong with him. They didn't trust him. They found him really rude. So even though he was doing work experience, he was fired after around 2 weeks. So they didn't give him a go with respect. Bell didn't take the rejection well. I mean, we know how he's been when he's applied for a job and not actually got it. He almost killed somebody then. And now here we are in a similar predicament where he's actually had 2 weeks of his life doing this work experience, and now he's been told no more. And the office manager, a woman called Faye Hjorth, she reportedly told him that he wasn't fit to clean the toilets and to piss off and not to return. Now, I don't know whether Faye Hjorth did that. I do not think he's kind of a savoury character that we'd be like, it'll be fine to say this kind of things to him. I think that saying to somebody that you're not fit to clean the toilets and to piss off, it's very, very inflammatory. And let's be honest, Belle doesn't come across as the quiet retiring type. If I had been Faye, I would not have said that to him. And I do not believe that she will have actually spoken those words. But either way, she has to let him go for very good reason. But unfortunately, in doing so, she has absolutely no idea of the fate that she has sealed for certain members of her staff. Because Belle is not going to accept this quietly. He's really angry. How dare they? How dare she tell him that he's not wanted? And bear in mind what we're talking about. If you have those personality traits that are really antisocial and it sits on a bed of festering and seething resentment because of your own experiences, and you don't like feeling that level of helplessness and abandonment that you had as a child, and it all comes to this position where you can project it in a direction that is undeserving, but nonetheless that you have power over, it can be a cooking pot of really problematic possibilities, and it will absolutely be in this case. On December the 8th, 2001, Belle returns to the Panmure RSA. It's 8 a.m. in the morning. He's obviously therefore thinking that the day staff are going to be present because it's 8 a.m. He's driven by his friend, a guy called Darnell Toop. He was 23 years of age at the time, and he was told he had to wait outside as a getaway driver. At this point, Belle goes into the RSA. He's actually wearing a police shirt. He's obviously returned to that scenario where he thinks that by stealing a police car or wearing a police shirt, that somehow he has the authority to do what he's about to do. And the reason he's likely wearing a police shirt is multifold. First of all, if you walk in wearing a police shirt, I'm going to instantly think, oh, is he a police officer? Even if I know that he was just doing work experience at the bar, I'm like, is he actually a police officer? It puts me on the back foot. I'm not going to challenge you. Secondly, that's going to give you some space and time to plan to do whatever it is you're planning to do. And thirdly, authority figures have power. So as an authority figure, we don't like to question people in uniform because we feel that they're in charge. He knows all of that. Equally, he's probably wearing it because he likes the feeling of confidence it gives him. He's psychologically put himself in a position where he's going to be all powerful, and the police shirt represents that part of his personality he's trying to convey in that moment, aside from the fact that police officers on the whole toe the law and he's somebody who breaks the law. Now, he's carrying a guitar case at the same time when he gets there, but the people inside, they're looking obviously at what that guitar case looks like, and it seems like a box standard guitar case, nothing to be concerned about. But little did they know that this guy has actually got a gun in that case. They could not have anticipated for one moment that their lives are in such mortal danger. Now, it's Susan Couch who opens the door for him. And when she does that, he says basically he needs to return a guitar. She knows him. She knows that he's done the work experience there. And her comment is, as we would imagine, oh, I didn't know you were with the police. So she allows him in. He's bringing back a guitar, no big deal. She's got no idea of the capacity of harm that this man holds. Now, once he gets inside, he draws the gun and at this point starts to threaten them. So he says to Susan, empty the safe. Now, there was less money than he was actually anticipating in the safe, and therefore he makes Susan open every single payslip, and he stole money from the wallets of the people inside. There were four people in the club at the time. This included Susan. Now, after taking that money, it's not enough. Because it was never about the money, was it? It was never about actually wanting to benefit financially. It was always about wanting an opportunity and a permission base to go and harm these human beings. This is not simply profiteering from his crimes. This is about the propensity of violence being given an opportunity to thrive. So after he's taken the money, he goes on to savagely beat them all. And he's using the butt of his gun to do that. Now you can imagine the weight of the butt of a gun, the heaviness, the horror that's being inflicted as he uses this to beat his victims senseless. He even shot one of his victims. And like I said, even though he shot one of his victims, the others are basically experiencing high levels of blunt force trauma, and that's because he's enjoying it. You know, you can shoot your victims dead with a gun. It's far quicker if you get it right to do that. That's not where his mindset is. That's not what he enjoys. He wants to punish them. They need to be beaten. They've hurt his feelings. Now that he's going to hurt them. It's as simple as that. His emotional collateral is going to come out physically in their collateral regarding the damages he does to their bodies. They are dehumanized. The way that he beats them is so horrific that their physical features are distorted and deformed. When they worked out the timeline of Bell's crime, he took about 15 minutes robbing the actual individuals at the bar. He took cigarettes. He took around $12,000 of cash. But then he spent about 30 minutes brutally attacking the four people who were inside. 30 minutes. Imagine the horror for those victims. But also imagine the enjoyment that he got. Beating people for 30 minutes? You've had a lot of time to consider your actions. You've had a lot of time to reconsider your actions as well. To carry on doing that, he's absolutely relishing it. He's absolutely connected to the violence and enjoys that violence. The poor victims that he attacks are William Absalom. He was actually known as Bill. He was 63. He was the president of the club. Wayne Johnson, he was 56. He had been one of the club's stalwarts. He'd basically been a really loyal club member for lots and lots of years. And he'd been there just setting up the pool tables. Mary Hobson, she was 44. She worked there as a cleaner, just going about her cleaning duties. And then Susan Couch, who let him in, she was 37. She just worked as a part-time accountant for the club. None of these individuals have had anything to do with him being dismissed. Now, when Bell comes out after this sustained, brutal, murderous attack, he realizes his getaway driver, Darnell, isn't there. Darnell had abandoned him. So instantly we're drawn to the conclusion that Darnell had taken him to that bar and didn't really know what was going to happen. I would imagine that Darnell thought that there was actually going to be a robbery, and if he heard a gunshot go off, he was probably spooked, or potentially he'd gone and had a look and realised that things were completely out of control and wanted no part of it. But certainly I do not believe for a second that Darnell arrived thinking that multiple murders were going to occur that morning. So this means Bell hasn't got a car, but he can solve that straight away. He steals Susan's car to get away from the scene of the crimes. Now, the person who has the sad reality of finding this utterly gruesome scene is Alan Eastwood. He's the vice president of the club. So he arrived at the club later that day, immediately is horrified, calls emergency services and says that there's three people who've been killed, but there's also one person that he believes is still alive but is severely injured. So Susan, who'd answered the door, she had survived, but she had survived with horrific, horrific injuries. Apparently she was lay on her back. She was breathing really heavily. She was moaning at the same time because she was in absolute pain and agony. And he said the left side of her face was just unrecognizably swollen. And of course, because he would be hitting her repeatedly and repeatedly with the butt of the gun. And when that's happening, you're not going to turn your face over so the person's going to have opportunity to do the other side. You're going to be rendered helpless and keep your head there. That's why one side of her face was so badly damaged. Now, after the actual massacre, Bell had retreated from the scene, taken the car, but then he'd gone to a shopping centre and then spent the night at a hotel. So no consequential thinking. He isn't considering what to do next. He hasn't made an escape. He hasn't driven off into the beyond, hoping that he's not going to be tailed. He's just gone around doing things that ordinary human beings would do, such as attend a shopping centre, and then he needs somewhere to stay, so he goes to a hotel at night. Apparently, he'd commented to Darnell that they were going down for this, going down big time for this. I'm imagining Darnell's thinking, I appreciate that you want to include me in your future plans, but I'm thinking, I don't like the we in this scenario. I think it's more of a you. It's more of a you are doing all those things, where I'm slightly different because I left. I wasn't there. I wasn't involved. But this is what he's telling Darnell, that they're going to go down for a very long time. You won't be surprised to know that the police caught them 5 days later. So at this point, he hadn't even left his own mother's. He was literally in bed at his mother's house. One can only ask the question, why did it take 5 days for this violent, dangerous man to be arrested when he was literally at his mother's home? But it does feel like there was, shall we say, some lackluster investigating during this particular crime spree. The actual investigators found a newspaper in his car, and this was from the newspaper The Herald, and the headline in that newspaper was, "Four bludgeoned for $12,000. And that was obviously referring to the murders that he'd carried out. And it's a very powerful message, even though it's horrific that the killer had decided to buy that or take that because he wanted a representative memory of it. The point is, the $12,000 is very poignant. Four bludgeoned, three murdered for a mere $12,000. But as you and I know, they weren't murdered for $12,000. $12,000 had nothing to do with it. He wouldn't have cared if he'd got $50. What matters was he had an opportunity to take out his murderous inclination in the most barbaric and brutal and devastating of ways. And he did so, I believe, with absolute glee. Now, whilst Bell is awaiting trial, his girlfriend actually gave birth to his baby girl. So again, this is a man who could have been looking towards the future with a beautiful little baby girl and a partner, but no. Because again, nobody matters to Bell aside from Bell himself. Now we get to 2002, the October of that year, the trial takes place. Of course, Bell denies the charges of murder and attempted murder. No, I didn't want to murder them. I don't want to attempt to murder them. I just wanted to steal. So yeah, he denies the charges of murder and attempted murder, but he eventually agrees that, okay, I did do robbery, so I'll plead guilty to that. He said, you know what? I never actually intended to hurt anyone, but I'd taken the gun as a warning. Just gonna throw it out there. If you didn't intend to hurt anyone, how come you hurt everyone? I know it's pretty staggering, isn't it? It's pretty staggering that I hurt everybody, even though I said I wasn't gonna hurt anybody. Yeah, and also, you didn't actually shoot all of them. The gun you used to injure and kill people with the butt of it using blunt force trauma. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's just a warning. I didn't actually use the gun to kill everybody. I just wanted to give them some light warnings in the form of blunt force trauma. You are a massive murderer. No, just a man with a gun for a warning. Honestly, how do they ever think that people will listen to that and not, I don't know, use the blunt end of a gun to give them a warning? That isn't legal. I don't know what I'm talking about. Anyway, the point is, he's saying, I never intended to hurt anybody. I just wanted to make them give me the money, even though we know that he took about 30 minutes to beat the life out of these human beings. Also, the reasoning behind this, shall we say, defence is he says that as he's leading Wayne through the building as part of this apparent robbery, Wayne had tried to grab the weapon for him. So Wayne had tried to be a hero, and what an amazing human being he was if he tried to do that, to try to protect other people. But then Bell said, and this is when the gun had accidentally gone off at a point blank range, killing him. Now, even if we're to believe that that happened, which we don't, even if we are to believe that, arguably, how does that then lead to him killing everybody else with the butt of the gun? How does that account for those actions? If anything, when you shot somebody accidentally, you're going to be leaving because, hell, it wasn't meant to go wrong. We were just meant to use the gun as a warning. Let's get out of here. I've got the money already. But no. Bell says, after that happens, the shit went off and that led to the murders and the attempted murder of the other. So responsibility-wise, he's saying it's all Wayne's fault. If he hadn't done that, I wouldn't have had to basically beat people to death with the butt of my gun. Makes no sense whatsoever. But this is what he's doing, is deflecting blame towards Wayne. In fact, he even went on to say everything was okay until he grabbed the barrel. We all know, just from his own insight to that circumstance and situation, that this is complete fabrication. He wanted to kill. And maybe Wayne did grab the gun. Maybe he was a hero in that context. And maybe he did get shot because that's how it was responded to, that Bell shot him to make it clear that he was meaning business.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
Terms and conditions apply. The idea that then he feels the way to manage the situation is to beat everybody else to death, it makes no sense whatsoever. One could argue, well, he didn't want to leave witnesses. But let's be clear, there are going to be very unsophisticated methods this man has used, as in there'll be forensic evidence everywhere. He's taking the guitar case in, he's not wearing gloves. He's obviously going to have his DNA everywhere. And there's also a reasoning behind why he might be there, in the fact that we know he has been sacked from his work experience position and he's likely come for revenge. So it wouldn't take a great sleuth to put that picture together. He kills those individuals not to get rid of the witnesses, but because he's enjoying the experience of beating them to death. Now, it was heard that he and Darnell had been drinking alcohol and smoking cannabis the night before. He also said that he'd been using methamphetamine, and he reckoned that when he reflected on what went on in the club, that he had, quote, blacked out. That's what he told family members. It's unbelievable, isn't it, that people can just use this kind of excuse. I just blacked out. I mean, I have very, very occasionally in my past, I'm not a big drinker. I'm just not. And also, alcohol and me don't always get on. And so it's not something I engage in a great deal. But I do remember on one occasion, I was really, really nervous, and I did end up drinking some neat vodka, and I don't remember anything else. Apparently it was quite hilarious getting me back home. I'm not going to talk about it more than that, but my brother did humiliate me on many occasions, referring and reclaiming that moment for himself, because he was the person who had to take me in the cab. The point is, you do at times black out, but at no point would I have been capable of doing what I've described in this crime. I wasn't capable of getting my boots off. So yes, you don't have a memory of it, but you certainly haven't been able to construct such a chaotic, traumatic and brutal murder as I've just described. But how convenient it is for him to suggest that he has no recollection of it by introducing this apparent drug-induced psychotic episode. Now, bear in mind, every single one of the victims has suffered from extreme wounds to the head. And apparently, Wayne, who was shot, he also had been bludgeoned after he'd been shot. Now, of course, we do have a survivor, thank God. Susan survived the beating, and she had been so close to death. It's not that she is lucky. No one is lucky surviving what I've described. I cannot imagine the trauma that woman has been dealt and the suffering she's endured. And her suffering is going to have been emotional, but wow, physically, she was really badly affected. So she had blood clots on the brain. She had a fractured skull. She had broken arms. Just put that into context. Broken arms. It's not easy in your 30s to break your arm. There's a significant injury when that happens. The likelihood is she was putting her hands up to defend herself, and he broke them because of that. We're talking about a man who was beating a woman so severely that she now, even today, is severely affected by the attack. She's got paralysis on the left side of her body. She has to use a stick to walk. She's got chronic tiredness. She's got damaged vocal cords. And the judge actually said, although she lives to be a mother to her young son, she now has significant disabilities. So she has had a great deal of her health and life and freedom stolen. And so too has her son got to grow up with a mother who doesn't have the capacity that she used to have. It's a capacity that was stolen by this thug. Susan did try her best to recount what she could remember of the attack. She said that Bell had laughed at her and basically said, "Are you crying, ladies?" So basically, she and Mary, who was unfortunately murdered in this case, as they're getting understandably very, very upset, he thinks it's funny. He's enjoying it. Imagine the level of sadism doing that, knowing what you're about to do as well, just enjoying seeing their pain. Mary was apparently on her knees. She was crying, she was praying, and she died whilst on the floor praying. And all I can hope is that she was embraced by her God the moment that she took her last breath. I hope that she was cradled into the next life in that prayer. Belle had actually started beating her from behind, and she had understandably at that point put her hands behind her head to try to shield herself from the blows. And as she'd done that, she'd been impacted so powerfully that the ring she was wearing on her finger was flattened during the attack. That's how powerfully she would start. Think about that. You maybe put your hands up, maybe they're on the back of your head, and somebody is flattening that ring with the impact of the blows. Mary also had reacted when she'd heard the gunshot, and Belle had actually said to her that Wayne tried to be a hero. So ultimately, as she's praying, as she's crying, as she's being laughed at and humiliated by this man as he's beating her, she's also responded to the fact that clearly Wayne is either mortally injured or dead, and he again has suggested that Wayne tried to be a hero. And none of that has dissuaded him from then going on and killing these other people. It was heard that during the attack, Belle had actually said, "I wish that bitch Faye was here," because of course that's the person that he's decided is ultimately responsible for his feelings. This is the manager who'd fired him. It must have been so very scary for her to have heard just how different her fate could have been if she'd been there when Belle arrived. I mean, he had the biggest grudge against her, so she was probably his prime target, and I imagine the aggression that he would have bestowed on her would have been even worse than what we've talked about so far with the other victims. It also emerged during the investigation that in the days leading up to the murders, Belle had actually been involved in two thefts. He'd stolen money from the St. George Tavern in Papatoetoe, and he'd stolen goods from an engineering company in Newmarket. Now, the reason this is staggeringly terrible is that staff had actually told the police detailed descriptions of Belle. They included his registration plate and his name. So how does that actually happen? You know, you just speak to the police and you're like, "We know who did it. It's amazing. You know, it's terrible that we've had these thefts occur, but the good thing is we have diligently done your detective work for you." "Oh, that's brilliant, brilliant. Because honestly, we're having quite a busy week, and it's great to know that you have gone to the trouble of clearly doing our work for us." That's right. So we know who it is. It's a guy called William Belle. He's quite a repetitive offender. But also, this is his car registration plate so that you can trace his address. But we'd just like to know how long it's going to take, because obviously we'd like the goods back, and also we'd like to have this person tried in the court of law, because that's legal due process. "Yeah, I'm not going to do anything with it." "Sorry?" "Yeah, I'm just not yet. Not yet. But this person's stolen from us, and we have evidence that he's stolen from us, and we've got all the identifying factors, including witnesses and names and registration details." "Yeah, I know, but I'm actually just going to watch The Sullivans on TV in my break, and I'll think about doing that in a few days' time." Honestly, that, I'm not saying The Sullivans were being watched. It was the only New Zealand soap from my childhood I could remember. People would be like, "Who are The Sullivans?" I know, who the Sullivans are. And I'm pretty sure it's contextual. I apologise if I've got it wrong. But anyway, why didn't the police act on those reports? Because, right, if the police had acted on those reports, he would never have been able to carry out the crime that he did because he'd have been banged up. Or at least under some kind of watch, because probation would know about him continuing to actually act in this way. And that would give him less opportunity and leverage to carry out the crime that I've covered, which is horrific. And those missed opportunities meant that he was able to commit the murders. That's how terrible the chain of causation is. Now, during the trial, Bell was as disrespectful and disgusting as we would imagine he would be. He chewed gum and he smirked. And is it just me? But I don't care about his human rights. If I was the judge in that case, I would have had my security go over to him. And like when you do it with children, put your hand out to get the gum. If that hadn't have happened, I would have brought in a dentist to physically have him restrained whilst said gum was removed. Then I would have had something potentially in a Hannibal Lecter type way put over his mouth so he wasn't able to have gum during the trial. It's just a disrespectful thing. Again, we're in the court of Emma, aren't we? We're in the court of Emma, but I believe that respect should be something that's minimally expected in these kind of scenarios, particularly in light of the victims' families. He also appeared emotionless when the jury returned the guilty verdicts, which clearly they were going to return because he was guilty as hell. There was literally a witness who said he was murdering us all. He was sentenced, you won't be surprised, to life in prison for the murders, and he was given a non-parole period of 33 years. Now, that was the longest non-parole sentence ever given in New Zealand history at the time. That's because in New Zealand, I would say, a bit like the UK, there is more of a lenient approach to offenders in the belief system that second chances are important and you can rehabilitate people. Bell cannot be rehabilitated. He had over 100 offences before going ahead and killing these innocent people. You can't rehabilitate Bell. Bell needs to be in a cell. Bell's in a cell. It rhymes. It's a good connection. That in itself should mean that we think clearly about never letting him be released, because we can ultimately put it into a variety of verses. Bell, cell, somebody called Michelle. I've got a mate who's got a Taco Bell. That's the use of bell twice. I digress. Anyway, the non-parole period is a big one. And bear in mind, this then gets appealed. Of course it does. And for some unknown reason, they're like, let's reduce it to 30 years. Why? Why don't we increase it to 68 years? Why don't we increase it to 3,764 years plus 20 years because he chewed gum in court, plus 50 years because he smirked in court, plus another 1,000 years just on the off chance that that wasn't enough to rehabilitate him? That's the kind of sentence I feel is appropriate. He also was sentenced to 13 years for attempted murder and 12 for aggravated robbery. Now, when it came down to the psychological reports, I imagine it just had a big stamp that said, very bad human, never release. But again, I don't actually design stamps for these kind of files. I'm just saying they would be appropriate stamps. But yes, the psychological report suggested that if Bell was ever to be released from prison, there was a very high likelihood that he would violently offend again. No one needs that written in a report, because if your past history is a good indicator and predictor of your future history, well, he had over 100 offences. Aside from on top of nearly beating somebody to death in a petrol station because he wasn't given a job, we also murdered 3 people and attempted to murder another person. Therefore, he's a serial offender and a serial killer. So he never should walk the streets again. I don't even think you're safe in a cell next door to him, let alone in a house next door. It's evident when you look at his crimes that when he was on parole, all of those past crimes didn't even concern him. He just carried on offending. So when he gets released, if he gets released, he'll just carry on offending. And terrifyingly, he'll be eligible for parole in 2031. Because the world's insane. Now, it's unlikely that he'll ever be released from prison, but I have covered cases before where these kind of absolute lunatics are allowed back on our streets. So I won't pretend to have the absolute sense of peace that I feel I should be able to have when telling a story like this, when considering this kind of perpetrator, because we have seen it happen before, where these murderous individuals who are a danger to everyone around them somehow are given freedom and then go on to do horrific things. And the thing about having an antisocial mindset, a psychopathic mindset, is you don't change. You don't change. And arguably that means that he'll get bigger and better at being a violent perpetrator whilst in prison. Now, Darnell, who is to some degree a co-conspirator, maybe in the robbery at least, or at least planning that initially, the guy who went with him to the actual place where he ended up carrying out the murders, he was found guilty of one count of aggravated robbery and of three counts of manslaughter. So he was actually given 12 years and he was eligible for parole after seven. He was actually found not guilty of the charges of murder and attempted murder, which makes sense. He wasn't actually doing it. He wasn't involved in it. Yes, he definitely went and he certainly is guilty of requiring a sentence, but he was not at the level that we're talking about where Bell is concerned. In fact, Darnell's defense really argued that Bell had conned him into acting as a getaway driver and said that he genuinely didn't realise what the extent would be in the RSA. He didn't know the plan of actual violence that was going to occur and couldn't have planned for that. The judge, however, said...
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Despite his role being comparatively minor to Bell's, he knew that a gun was being taken inside and that to carry out a robbery was a really serious offence anyway, because if you have arms with you, you've carried an actually loaded gun, of course there might be damage that was done. And he still went along with it. Now, when it came down to Bell being sentenced, well, what was the reaction? I do love New Zealand people, I really do, because they just say it how it is. It's as simple as that. They're not going to hold back. One of Bill's friends, the guy who was murdered in the RSA siege, he said that it should be an eye for an eye and that William had caused heartache, anguish and hate. I completely understand that. I think many of us would feel that way if somebody we loved had been murdered so brutally. Also, Wayne's brother, the guy who was shot and then bludgeoned, he said that William deserves the gallows and also went on to say that's what he would have gotten a few years ago. So he feels he should be killed. He also said that taking him to the tip, shooting him and leaving him for the rats and seagulls to pick his bones would be a pretty appropriate measure. Oh, just think me and this guy get on quite well. Just he's in the world of potential outcomes for individuals that get involved in horrific crimes that I also play out in my mind. I do kind of have an empathy with wanting to take him to the tip, shoot him and leave him for the rats and seagulls to pick his bones. I do feel that there would be some satisfaction in playing that out, at least in my fantasy. Obviously, not in reality. We all understand that the human rights conventions are there to prevent people like that getting away with doing things like that. But we all have an empathy with why people may want to do things like that. Then we've got Baehyeo. She, remember, hired him and also sacked him. And she said that she would always wonder, what if I'd never taken him on? So she feels this survivor guilt that she shouldn't feel, but she can't help feel. She believes she introduced danger and darkness and death into a world that had been safe. She said she would always live with the memory of the revenge he'd taken. And though he's out of the way now and he couldn't hurt anyone else, it still haunts her, and absolutely it will. Detective Inspector Gavin Jones, he worked on the case, he said that Bell was the closest thing he had ever seen to a psychopath. No. Detective Inspector Gavin Jones, he's not the closest thing you have ever seen to a psychopath. Honestly, this Bell guy, he's the closest thing I've ever seen to a psychopath. He isn't though, is he? Yes, he is. He's close. He's very close. Basically, psychopaths have got low empathy, a callous regard They're an individual who takes no responsibility for their crimes. They're individuals who seem to show no guilt and joy, imparting fear into their victims. They're individuals who don't change. They're violent often, they manipulate, they exploit, and in the very severe end, they're actually serial killers. So he's very close to that. He is that. He is that detective. He is that. He's a psychopath. He's not got a tendency to work. He is it. He embodies it. It's going to look in my dictionary. Look, psychopath. And there's a picture of Bell next to it. Honestly, I appreciate it. I'm just quoting him. But the closest thing he'd ever seen to a psychopath, like, he literally is the description of a psychopath. And he did actually describe Bell as a callous, cunning and calculating psychopathic murderer. So I appreciate he wasn't saying that he isn't a psychopath. It's just that, you know, the closest thing he'd ever seen to a psychopath. And arguably, that's because psychopaths of this level are rare. So what he's really saying in that is ultimately in his career, when you think about all of the cases that he's been involved in, Bell examples exactly what we would imagine a psychopath would example. So all the killers that he's worked with, all of the individuals that have been manipulative and predatory, all of those who are callous in nature that he will have dealt with in his career, none have been as clearly psychopathic as Bell. And that's ultimately true. And this detective actually said, make no mistake about it, when he went to do that robbery, he was never going to leave anybody alive. Now, in a statement that was released as well, Susan Couch, who was the victim who survived, she later said that she hoped his long sentence would be a deterrent for anyone else who might want to commit such horrific acts. She said, for many of us, though, sentencing is a hollow sort of victory as the damage to us has been done and can never be undone. And like I said, the psychological and physical scars for Susan are enormous. Now, there was later an internal inquiry in the corrections department to look at Bell's release from prison on probation for his earlier aggravated robbery charge. And it was found that the management of his release conditions were poor. Yes, they were. You weren't even checking on him. He didn't go through and follow any of the guidelines. He should have been banged up. That's why people died, because you didn't follow your guidelines. Let's be honest. They found out 11 areas of poor management, and it was found that the Monger probation service was basically understaffed, suffered from poor management, and the workers had low morale. Not going to allow that as an excuse, you know? A lot of us, we have bad days at work, right? But if you're working in an arena or in an area that actually can cause the death of other people if you're not doing your job, you don't get to have a bad day. You just get to get on with it. Simple as, don't do the job unless you're willing to commit to the seriousness of the job. At the end of the day, he didn't follow any of the principles and guidelines. And if he wasn't doing it, neither was anybody else. It's not as if in that office there's going to be a few people that are being looked at closely. They're not going to be doing it with anybody. People would have been carte blanche not going ahead and following the procedure. That's so dangerous beyond measure. And it's terrible that these kind of heinous crimes have to highlight these failings, because the idea that others could equally have been out there doing exactly what he was doing without any kind of protective mechanisms, it's terrifying. And suddenly these kind of heinous crimes occur and then everyone takes a look. But bear in mind the damage that must have been going on with other offenders who were out on parole, not being supervised, without a shadow of a doubt, that is horrific and terrifying, and an indictment of those services. Now, in May 2004, Bell was actually found hanging by a bedsheet in his cell. So a nurse had actually been due to give him some medication. He was still breathing. They then take him to hospital, and they did get him back into prison the following day. But they genuinely felt, authority-wise, that he'd actually done that as a part of an attempt to escape from prison. So he was thinking that maybe he'd get taken to hospital and then he'd been able to escape. They don't think it was necessarily a genuine attempt on his life. I can't say whether it was or otherwise, but arguably he does have a mindset of somebody who'd be willing to risk his life to get what he wants in the long term, which in this case is freedom. Apparently, he had actually done something similar when imprisoned in the past for an unrelated crime. so they feel there is a context to that behaviour. Someone at the Panmure RSA commented that it was a shame that he didn't succeed when he was in last time. And I understand why, because if he had succeeded the first attempt on his life, then nobody else would have died, as opposed to three other people being murdered and one other person having their life drastically altered. She also commented that the majority of people who were in the RSA felt exactly the same. So they were not bestowing any sympathy or empathy onto Bell. They essentially wanted him dead. Now, in 2007, Darnell, who obviously had a much shorter sentence, he gets released from prison on parole. However, he was later arrested again on the charges of injuring with intent and also driving while disqualified. So it's good to know the system's working really well and is reducing or reoffending. On December the 10th, 2007, Bell actually got attacked in prison by a fellow inmate, a guy called Dean Shepherd. Dean Shepherd was also a convicted murderer. Whilst Bell was actually in the telephone room making a call, Dean walked in and out of the room a few times. Apparently the reason he was doing this, kind of coming in and leaving, was he was trying to prepare himself mentally. Then he attacked Bell with a weapon that was made from a sharp metal, components of a lever arch file, so he kind of fashioned a shank, I suppose. And he actually stabbed Bell in the left eye. Then when Bell fell to the ground, he actually hit him on the back of the head in an apparent frenzied rage. And Dean just constantly was going for the eyes, but Bell actually managed to protect himself from further damage. Understandably, he was going for the eyes because you're going to be able to do irreparable damage there if you manage to land blows with a sharp implement. So it was clearly very premeditated and clearly a very dangerous attack. And even
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Now I digress with my kind of fun fantasies about what could happen to these individuals that I talk about. Clearly, when they're in prison, this should not be allowed to occur. The idea that somebody can fashion a shank and try to blind another inmate is truly horrific, particularly in light of the fact that this is another murderer doing it. And again, what is that saying about the changing nature of these individuals? It's saying that they're not changing, isn't it? We have a murderer going and trying to murder somebody else in prison. Now, as soon as Dean had been forcibly removed by prison guards because they heard the screaming, Bell was taken to hospital. That's where he was treated. He had indeed suffered from a punctured left eyelid. He had internal bleeding. He had a fractured eye socket and he had a lot of cuts and bruises and abrasions on his head and face. Dean was actually sentenced to 10 years in prison for that, and that will be served concurrently to the 17-year sentence he received for murdering his landlady over a dispute about rent. Genuinely, just like Bell, Dean is the same kind of mindset, isn't he? And also, concurrently, what is this concurrent BS? He almost killed another person in prison and he's just going to get 10 years, but it's going to be served at the same time as a 17-year sentence. He's somebody who's shown he's not safe to be in our community. I know this is a different case, but it blows my mind that they're just like, oh, we can serve it at the same time, not after the 17 years. So it doesn't become 27 years. He got no consequences for doing what I've just said. Now in court, Dean said that his motivation for attacking Bell was that he was sick and tired of making derogatory comments about the people he killed. So even though Dean killed his landlady in an argument over rent, he has a spectrum of acceptability. And Bell talking negatively about his victims is just a step too far. Murder, not a problem. Go ahead, murder over really petty things, crack on. But the minute you start saying negative things about the people that you've murdered, well, that's a step too far. I'm going to get the shank. I'm going to blind you. Honestly, that's his mindset. You cannot work with this kind of logic. He said that he'd actually sharpened the pieces of metal for 2 hours to use in the attack. So one imagines he isn't very ashamed by it. I don't know. Often we downplay these things, don't we? Oh, I just found it. Just found the shank. It was just there. And then I just did it. I wasn't really thinking about it. Not him. He's like, I sat and I sharpened it for 2 hours before trying to take his eyes out for saying nasty things about people and using hurty words about people. Nothing to be scared of. Let's just give him exactly the same sentence he had before. What's to worry about? What's to worry about? What can possibly go wrong? What can possibly go wrong? Anyway, that actually happened. Now, in 2012, Susan, who was the victim in that horrific robbery and murder, she sued the corrections department for $500,000. She said that Bell was not being adequately supervised when he was released from prison when he carried out the attack. And she was eventually awarded $300,000 in punitive damages 11 years later. 11 years. Disgraceful. She's a victim because of their failures. And yet she has to wait 11 years and then only gets $300,000, which when you consider the injuries that she had is nothing. And her lawyer actually said that they still need to receive proper compensation as the amount that was given came to just $10,000 a year for over 30 years. And that's true because she's going to live more than 30 years. So it's going to be negligible. And he believes that a sum that would actually respect what she went through would be about $10 million because she'd suffered extraordinarily. And she has. She actually had to go on social welfare because she's had these life-changing injuries. And she said that she had really mixed emotions about the money she received. She said it was the closest thing that she got to an apology and that was at least a validation of her suffering. And she commented that she was just absolutely exhausted. She dealt with it for such a long time, they'd drawn it out for such a long time, that just getting something that was at least close to them saying, we messed up, it was at least something that validated what she'd endured. Now, in 2017, Bell actually got charged for watching a pornographic film in his prison cell because it seemed you can get pretty much everything in prison, even though you're meant to be serving a sentence for doing these reprehensible things. Obviously, pornography is contraband and he got told off for that, shall we say, but nothing seriously happened. And then in 2019, Bell had been working in the prison kitchen. I mean, of course. What should we do with somebody who is a violent killer, also has a very poor impulse control, and can act in ways so deplorable that humanity needs to be kept safe from him forever? Well, I've been thinking about giving her a job in a kitchen, because I think one of the things about kitchens is there's never anything that could do any damage to anybody. Isn't there knives? Oh, there's knives. Isn't there, like, boiling oil? Oh, goodness me, there is boiling oil. Isn't there large, heavy-based pans for catering for large groups of people? Oh, now you come to think of it, you're absolutely right. There's quite a range of implements that could do serious damage. But anyway, it'll be fine. It'll be fine. We don't need to think about doing things like supervising him. Why change anything that's occurred in this individual's lives? Let's just crack on and hope for the best. Anyway, genuinely, he was working in the prison kitchen. But thank the Lord, he was taken off this duty because, I kid you not, there was a rumour he was going to poison the staff. Just going to do a bit of light poisoning. A bit of light poisoning. Just going to get a bit of mercury, maybe a bit of cyanide, maybe a bit of bleach, whatever I can come across in this area. And I'm just going to poison all the staff. So another prisoner had passed that on. Also, another prisoner on top of this said that Bell was actually planning to take a member of staff hostage because he wanted to escape. So after these very serious incidents, he was classed as a maximum security prisoner. Why wasn't he classed as a maximum security prisoner before this? I have no idea. Anyway, Bell wasn't happy with this. Bell was like, why am I being classed as a maximum security prisoner? Because you consistently offended and you murdered 3 people and almost killed another person. In fact, another 2 people. So therefore, you're a maximum security prisoner. But I don't think I am. I think that I'm nearly a maximum security, but not quite, because there are others who are worse than me, who are in maximum security. So I just think you should acknowledge that I'm nearly max, but I'm not quite max to the max. So I should be allowed to stay in the kitchen with the objects that can kill people, even though I've been shown to use objects to kill people. Anyway, he literally challenges the reclassification of that security status and says, no, I should be moved to a lower security prison. I don't even need to work in this kitchen. I shouldn't even work in this kitchen. I should be working in a kitchen at a lower security place. What kind of a lower security place? An open prison. I should be allowed in the kitchen at an open prison where I can just wander off out there to freedom. Genuinely, this was the argument. It's crazy that the taxpayers are paying for this case to be brought, because that's what's happening. He's so arrogant, so devoid of connection and responsibility and accountability to what's actually happened, that he doesn't just argue that he wants to be able to be doing the jobs that he's clearly a risk to be doing. He wants to be moved to a lower security prison because he doesn't feel it's appropriate. He's been considered a maximum security risk. You won't be surprised. They were like, no, we're not going to go along with that. So he lost his legal challenge, and it was argued that if he did escape, he would actually be considered to be an extremely high risk to the public. Of course, he was, he is, he will always be. The bigger question is, why do these cases get brought? Why is anybody allowed legal counsel? I don't care about human rights. You've lost your human rights when you've done the things that Bell did. This man is never going to be safe to ever walk the streets. This man is somebody who is a threat to human life, no matter how old he gets. And even if people believe that in 20 years' time, maybe he's changed, don't take the risk. Don't take the risk. People take those risks and people die. And the thing that we know about him, he has potential, capacity, and history. Therefore, he's never going to be safe to walk the streets. And like I said, this case is one of those where you look at the historical fractures, you look at the generational damage, and it's mind-blowing. He was a victim. He was a terribly, terribly abused child. And I stand by that. I stand by the fact that Bell did not deserve what happened to him as a child. But he has these personality traits and characteristics that are also malevolent and dark beneath the surface. So ultimately, sympathy and empathy we would usually feel and direct towards him, it changes. Because he held on to all of the darkness and amplified that. That's his true nature. Irrespective of the horror that he endured, his true nature is malevolent. And it's evident by the actions that we've looked at today. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.